I'm here today with Richard McCann, and we're going to talk about his book coming out from Pantheon in April, Mother of Sorrows. It's a very beautiful collection of stories, and we're going to talk about your earlier work, too. In Ghost Letters, you describe a photograph of people in a burning house, and you describe the fire as it wants a trap and a way out, and it seems to me that that pretty well describes the narrator's relationship with his past and Mother of Sorrows. Trying to come to terms with it through examination, through storytelling, is the trap and the way out.
First, let me say that I like it that you combine question Ghost Letters, a collection of poems, with Mother of Sorrows, which is prose and which is nine stories, I think, that fit together and make something like a novel. Because I think the concerns are not really terribly different between the two works, even though the forms are. That quote, a people in a burning house and being burned in it, and it fires at once a trap and a way out, is from a poem actually I wrote for my brother, David, who is a character in Mother of Sorrows. It's actually an older poem. It's not as old as the image I had in mind for that line, but the image I had in mind of people in a house that was burning around them was actually the image of the Symbionese Liberation Army house burning, with the people from the SLA inside that house being burned alive. I remember in the writing of it thinking of that house in really literal terms of my brother's and my childhood house, you know, that the desire to escape that house and the ways in which escape, I suppose, also felt like a death for us. You know, how could we live outside that house where we had been? At the time, I also actually remember thinking of that in terms of that the house was also America, not just the house in which I was raised. And I think this is where the Symbionese Liberation Army, you know, Patty Hearst and Cinque and all those people came into it, was that they were trying to flee the house of America, and they were also very deeply trapped in it, in their own violence and stuff. I guess that double-edged movement, you know, of being in a fire that is at once obliterating and liberating, seems to me very tied to the work of autobiographical writing, which my work is. Often it seems to me that autobiographical writing has in it a kind of doubleness about the painfulness of looking at the self and the ways in which one sometimes feels obliterated and also recreated by examining the self and also by proposing a self in writing.
So when you were in the process of writing those stories, do you feel like it, in a way, in that sort of examination, in that self-examination, that examination of your past and your history, do you feel like it did help you to recreate yourself and reimagining it?
I hope so. That was the aim of writing the stories in some ways. I turned to fiction, I suppose. I'd never written fiction in any serious way until about 20 years ago. I started giving it a try, and it was actually right after I moved back to the United States after living abroad for some years. And I was in Washington, which is where I grew up. And I was walking up Connecticut Avenue, and it was a hot summer day. It was August, and the bus passed me by and left me in its wake of black noxious gases. It was like 104 degrees, and I was miserable. And I thought, this is what my life feels like. This is what it felt like growing up. And I remember thinking, growing up. And I'd never really taken that on as a subject. I'd never written, even in poetry, very much about what it meant to be a child. To me, the great effort of life as a child was close your eyes and wait until you stop being a child and you can flee the small suburban house and get to someplace grand and fabulous. And here I was returned, you know, and returned pretty much, you know, a few miles from where I grew up. And I found that very difficult. And in some ways, I think I began writing narratives to kind of try and figure out what the narrative was that I had been raised in. My mother was a really good storyteller. She was an inadvertent storyteller. She was actually kind of a rambler in speech, but she was so good at sort of mythicizing herself and making herself dramatic that I think I learned something about my first-person narration from her, but also sort of felt like a necessity, if you will, to start narrating something on my own. Because when I was younger, I think one of the reasons I actually didn't write about childhood was not only that I wanted to flee it, but I really had no way to apprehend my childhood or to apprehend my family other than the ways in which my mother had kind of done so. I would retell her stories, as it were, you know, and try maybe give them a little flourish, a signature gesture, you know. But they were hers. They weren't mine. And so narrative for me was a way of kind of trying to stake out a territory of myself, and to stake out a narrator too, which meant that there would have to be somebody who was perceiving, a consciousness that was perceiving, who wasn't the same one as I had exactly, you know, who's going to be maybe a little bit farther ahead of me, you know.
Why did you decide to write the narratives as fiction instead of memoir? Because it is deeply autobiographical. Mm-hmm. And sort of a related question, what do you think the poems do? Because some of the poems do deal with the same material. What is it that the poems can do that the stories can't do, and, you know, vice versa?
First of all, I guess I should say about fiction and memoir, I am my mother's son, and that impulse toward mythomania is mine as well. And I never thought in writing these stories that they were fiction, and I never quite thought they were memoir. If I thought of them one way or another, I thought of them more as nonfiction than fiction. But I was aware that I was traveling away from facts, and sometimes in a large way. And ultimately, the decision to publish this as fiction had to do with the fact that I really had stepped away from fact in some pretty significant ways in a number of them. The narrator of the last story, the same narrator all the way throughout, but in the last story he has HIV. I don't. When I wrote that story, I had thought he needs a really big disease, and I only have liver disease, you know, which in fact I have. I thought my disease was not sufficiently dramatic, you know. I just need to wait and find out that wasn't true by events that happened later. But things like that seem to me, you know, to really say, you know, this has moved mm-hmm. into the realm of fiction. I find the line between those things pretty difficult. I find it difficult in the usual way, that is to say, what is remembered truth, and how reliable is memory, and in what ways do we make myth out of memory, and I think we do. But I also find it difficult because once I'm into something, I feel like I've got an allegiance to the way things start to unfold. And I never plan that things are going to fold away from the facts. It's never my intention. I never, ever have started writing by saying, in a sort of holiday mood, what can I invent today? You know, it's just that something's moving in a certain way, and I see a prospect, and I try it. And it may not be the literal truth, and it seems to me something I want to go with. I suppose often that's meant some of the things people often do. It's meant compressing time. It's meant exaggerating characters. Above all, it's meant leaving things out. And that Mother of Sorrows is a family of four. I actually have had two brothers. Mine was a family of five. And there are things that are so significantly different that I thought, well, really, I am following a kind of imaginative impulse here as much as I am an autobiographical impulse. I'm allowing both to interplay with each other. And that's what I think of this work as being. I think of it as being, in poetry actually as well, as fiction, if I may use that word. I think of Mother of Sorrows as being a kind of homage to reality. It's not reality. It is not exactly the way reality was, but it is an homage to a particular lived reality. And I think of the poems rather in the same way. You know, in poetry, people don't ask these same kinds of questions. You know, there's an assumption in poetry, and I wrote poetry for a long time, that it is at once autobiographical and not autobiographical.
Right.
You know? And in fiction, you know, one is asked to be a little bit, particularly in the post-Jason Blair age of fact-checking, one is asked to be a little bit clearer about that.
You know, a lot of the work is concerned with the project of it is this narrator, and even in the poems too, is trying to come to some sort of terms with the past. And I do sort of want to hear your take on that, because the Mother of Sorrows ends with those two characters. Who goes there in the dark, I whisper. We do, Helen answers. And they're sort of out on the boat, and they're out on the lake, and I believe they're seeing their sort of reflections in this...
The water's too dark for them to see themselves reflected in its night.
Yeah. The Helen character is struggling to come to terms with a very tragic past, the death of her young son. And the other character is struggling to come to terms with his present, certainly with his illness, but he's also struggling to come to terms with all this death that's accumulated, all these friends who have died. And that ending, to me, it does seem to imply that it's maybe not possible for them to come to terms with those pasts, that they sort of have to maybe live within those pasts. They're sort of, I don't know if I want to use the word condemned, but I can't think of another one, to wander those pasts, to live inside of that history.
Yes, that is a very dark ending, and the narrator and his good friend Helen, whose son has died, and the narrator's lost many people to AIDS and other things, and he himself is sick, are out in a boat in the middle of the lake. But the line he says to her, who goes there in the dark, is actually a line he remembers his brother having said as a child, when his brother, now dead, used to hide in the shrubs by the front porch at night, and when somebody would go past, the brother would go, "Who goes there?" To me, it's significant that the narrator is saying something his brother said a long time ago. Significant in a couple of ways. In other stories, one would find that he's actually had a hard time reconciling himself to the ways in which he's like his brother. And so he's sort of, I think there's a kind of nice merging of him and his brother there that he's often refused, mm-hmm. You know. But also, he's using what he's saying years later, something his brother said as a child, which is to say, he's memorializing, you know, in language through the act of saying something. He's also making, I guess, a metaphysical point. He's also remembering his brother, you know, who said that long ago. And in that way, yeah, I think there is no escaping the past. You know, they are out in a rowboat in the middle of a dark lake, and it's actually the evening of Tisha B'Av, of the Jewish holiday, and they're out there because it's Saint Kaddish for the character Helen's son. But I like to think that who goes there in the dark? We do, Helen answers. That in the dark is equalized by who goes there, by the action of that verb. Are you marred? Yes. Are you moving through the dark? Yes. Is the past difficult? Is memory difficult? Yes. Are you moving? Yes. Then you're alive. Yeah.
They're also together, you know, yes. And one of the things that I like about that story is that they're together through some difficulty in the story. I mean, they're supposed to sort of go and memorialize her son, and it doesn't quite work out the way they want it to, and it works out in this other way. I guess that sort of leads me to leap to another question I was going to ask later, but I do think of a lot of your work, the stories, the poems, they read like elegies to me.
I actually think of my work as really elegiac also in a lot of ways. Not just that, or I also think of it as sometimes, particularly in ghost letters, I think sort of redefining what the elegiac, or attempting to redefine, let me not be reached too far, what the elegiac might consist of. We think of an elegy as a memorial. We think of an elegy as a tribute. But it actually does do, there's a beautiful set of elegies by Paul Monnet that I really love called For Love Alone, 18 Elegies to Raj. And they are very hard, fast-moving, wrenching, shouting, angry, weeping poems. They're very tilted out over the top, and they're very beautiful. In one of them, the first one, I think, the narrator, who's Paul Monnet, is at the grave of his now dead partner, and he's saying that there's only one green thing left now that the partner is dead, and the green thing is here, right here. He keeps saying here, right here, you know. And he also points out that where he is, that the narrator is also sick. And I love that here, right here, because I think one of the things the elegy really does is it takes that which is absent and makes it present again. It's not eulogizing, it's not just lamenting, but it's also a real effort of taking what is there and making it here, you know, taking that which is gone and making it present. I think my work is really kind of, if you were to rub two opposite forces together, that you would find maybe those forces are the effort to preserve and the effort to escape. Sort of like what you asked in the first question. And I think that a lot of the elegiac impulse comes from that effort to preserve, and also because I think in ghost letters, a lot of those poems really are coming out of the experience of the AIDS pandemic. It's hard even to sort of re-enter some of that time. But
yeah, I was thinking when you were talking at the end of The Way We Live Now, when Susan Sontag says, she says something like, in a photograph or painting, you can't say, I think she said something, you can't say is, because the fact of the photograph automatically conjures the past. But she says in a story or in a poem or in language, you can say, he's still here. And I think the story ends with the lines, he's still here. And that's her, part of her memorial to all of her dead friends.
As a teacher, you know, I'm often in the position of explaining to my students why, when writing about a work of literature, they say, the character so-and-so is going down the street. You know, the way in which the form in critical analysis that works of literature to be discussed as if they're forever in the present, you know. And there's something to that, you know, about what it is I think we want from the encoding into language.
I guess you've talked about this a little bit. You sort of talked about reinventing the self. Is that the purpose of examining our history? Is that, I mean, you said that you actually felt like it had helped you to sort of reinvent yourself.
The thing I didn't mention is that I began writing prose at the exact same time I went into psychotherapy the first time. And those are not, I think, coincidental processes, since they're both essentially narrative enterprises about trying to find structures for stories, you know, that might not be the structures that were the ones delivered to you, the received structures, and trying to find out the role of the narrator, oneself, one's endlessly interesting, wonderful self within those stories. And I guess I sort of think, you know, I don't really know what I think about inventing a self. I don't want to make any claims for, you know, a reinvented self exactly. You know, you say that, and then that night you think, my God, that was my mother speaking when I just said that. You know, these claims that people make for a new and authentic self worry me. You know, they seem very large sometimes. Nonetheless, I guess I have thought of writing as a kind of way to apprehend myself in some way that had not been possible without it. I stopped writing. I wrote when I was in my 20s, and I stopped when I was about 26 until I was about 34. And a lot of that stopping, I think, had to do with the more I wrote, the more I was beginning to stumble upon a self who was making me really uncomfortable. For instance, he had things to say about sex, you know, that made me really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very uncomfortable. I don't think until Ghost Letters I ever wrote anything that had any anger in it. That was not something I was comfortable voicing at all. You know, and in a lot of ways, I think I stopped writing because I was starting to kind of engender a self whom I couldn't deal with. You know, he scared me. So I just dropped him. We broke up. And when I started again, I really did, I have felt at many points that what it would mean to keep writing would be to keep being able to risk a kind of self-discovery and to risk a kind of steady broadening of what the pronoun I might mean to me, you know, to admit more and more and more.
So I'm going to jump ahead to a question because that sort of brings up tone for me. The tone of the last story, My Brother in the Basement, I think it is different from the tone of the other stories in the collection. And I think that part of it is angrier. I think it's a little less forgiving of the mother. I mean, even though there's still that incredible connection there. I know that you said earlier that story feels different in tone to you as well.
Mm-hmm, it does. And if I were to chart a kind of like tonal diagram, you know, for myself, I think, you know, I began someone writing prose as a poet, and I began interested largely in the lyrical prospects of prose, and over time I've gotten more and more interested in some of the other prospects, you know, the more frankly narrative prospects. I really love beautifully made language. I mean, I'm a sucker for it most every time, on public transportation and bars. You know, all you have to do is say a nice sentence. But I don't want to get suckered by it too much, you know.
What do you think are the dangers of getting suckered by it?
A couple of things. One, the danger of what Dick Bausch once called language-languaging. More urgently, for me, you can fall into the rhythm of a kind of beautiful sentence, and it takes you farther and farther from the true thing you might want to say. It's a rhythm you know. And sometimes I think also, for me, something I've really have struggled with at times is in my compulsive revising, and I'm incredibly compulsive about revising, and I want to make everything gem-like, I feel I have to warn myself off it so that things don't get all too hard, the surfaces don't get too hard or too polished,
right.
So that they resist a reader or resist feeling. And the aim of language for me, you know, as a writer, is to produce feeling. And one of the difficulties in writing is that you have to have the feelings to produce them. One isn't always that eager, after all. And maybe a kind of defense, I think, sometimes is you can make things too beautiful because the feeling kind of gets beautied out. In My Brother in the Basement, that's a story that's really based on my autobiographical thing, on the fact I had a brother who was a year older than I, who was also gay. His name was David, and we were Ricky and David Nelson, and people always thought of us in these kind of almost twin kind of ways. And we were very different and very alike, both. And I suppose in our families, it would be fair to say that I was the good boy and he was the bad. It was how it was understood. It's a very gross and pathetic reading of the situation. But that was the one we were given to understand. And I have felt bad for many years. My brother died of an overdose 20 years ago this year. And I have felt very bad for many years about ways in which I did not support him in the last few years of his life. He was a very difficult person, but I wasn't always supporting him. For instance, he was far more out in my family than I was. He was much more out there in terms of being out as a gay person than I was. I was always trying to be a pleasing homosexual, you know. He wasn't interested in that, not at all. In fact, he was quite interested in being displeasing, you know, the other end of the spectrum. And I wanted in that story to start approaching him in a way different than I had before. It wasn't my intention to heal our relationship through a story. It's kind of late. As the old Amharic saying goes, you can't build a house for last winter. But I did want to approach our relationship, and that story took me by surprise in a lot of ways. I think there are some very long scenes in there that are, to me, horrible and also very strangely funny, you know. And as scenes, they're very long and they're very full of, they're very dialogue-y. And that's not the way I usually go. I usually try to keep speech, you know, in a more crystalline kind of form. But there I really wanted to. And I didn't want to observe the... I couldn't observe, it wasn't a choice, the lyrical so much, because I was aware of the fact that more anger was beginning to flow into that story than I had anticipated. You know, you say to your students sometimes, what is the story you plan never to tell in your life, you know? And I knew that that was the story I planned never to tell in my life, was this my story with my brother, my dear brother. And my editor was really on my case because I turned in this book without that story. And he kept saying, you know, the brother has a bit of a shadowy presence in this book. You know, you need to bring him up. And I was like, well, I can't, you know. And he was like, no, he really has to. I was like, doesn't need to, you know. And he's like, no, he has to. And I understood this meant, you know, like, deal breaker has to. And finally, he said, just write a really short story, like 5 pages about your brother. And I said, okay, I can do that, 5 pages. And I thought, okay, I can do 5 pages. It was almost as if somebody had said to me, you only need to think about something painful for 10 minutes, I promise. And once I took that agreement, that's the longest story I've ever written. You know, it's like a 40-page story. Once I made that agreement, I couldn't stop. You know, it had its own momentum. And I was very glad he made that insistence, very glad, because I was ducking. He was right. I mean, the brother was too much a shadow. And what was, in fact, in my mind, originally a book primarily about a mother and a son became a book about 3 people through the addition of that story primarily.
Well, again, that's sort of going to lead me to something that I was thinking about when I was reading the essays, which is, again, that sort of that difference in tone, particularly in Resurrectionist, where I felt, again, because you are a very lyrical writer and you have a gift for that, and it's a great pleasure to read those very beautifully, skillfully crafted sentences. And I really felt like, particularly in Resurrectionist, that there was a real resistance. You were really resisting that lyrical impulse in the way that the essay keeps refusing. I don't know, different maybe sentimental ideas of who this person might be and what this relation might be, and trying to see it. It feels like it's trying to see it with a kind of clarity, that's the important thing, is to see it clearly. And so once again, the language of that felt very different, even though it's still very, you know, it's very precise. It's not as lyrical as your other stuff. Do you agree with that?
I don't know if I do or not. I should say, just by way of, because you know the whole story of this essay, The Resurrectionist, and right now I'm working on a collection of essays. I'm not supposed to use that word because it's so deadly in terms of publishing, but working on a collection of autobiographical narratives that arise from the occasion of a liver transplant I had in 1996, and that you, of course, know tons about because you were one of the people who really helped me through that time. And The Resurrectionist is about that. And the essay and this collection of essays are about the experience of illness and the experience of mortality and what it means to live in a body like mine that is being kept alive through the organ of someone else who is now dead, my liver in this case. I've actually enjoyed writing those essays, the ones I've done so far, including The Resurrectionist. They've probably been among the hardest things I've ever written because that was an incredibly traumatic experience. And also parts of it are real lost to me. I was on a lot of steroids. I had to go on, as many transplant recipients do, I was on so many steroids, I became psychotic and had to go on Haldol. I mean, it's not exactly all crystalline in my mind. And maybe if you sense, I don't know, but maybe if you sense a desire for great clarity, maybe it's actually partly a desire of mine to try and figure out what the hell happened in an experience that actually is in some ways extremely stark and clear to me, and in other ways quite gauzy, you know, since I was medicated a lot of that time, and also because when you have end-stage liver disease, as I have, you often have encephalopathy, mental confusion. You know, you might probably remember I was really confused, you know. So part of it is that, but about the lyrical, those essays specifically come out of a desire of mine. I used to go to a transplant support group, and I should go back, actually. But even there, I became aware that there were ways you were supposed to talk about the transplant that were acceptable and ways that were considered a little too dark, you know. And that as long as you were kind of on the page of, yes, sir, my donor gave me my gift of life, you know, you were doing great, you know. But if you strayed into less well-illuminated territory, such as the fact that your donor didn't actually donate something to you, the person was dead. Or if you strayed into the way that, yes, it's a gift of life predicated on death, you know, as all life is, then the transplant support group was a little more urging you to quiet down. And I didn't want to quiet down. I couldn't quiet down. I found it a very difficult, I think many people do, a difficult psychological adjustment to be alive through the offices of another person's death. Very difficult adjustment. So in those essays, I really feel like there's a lot of different kinds of language slamming up against other kinds of language mm-hmm. together. I've really wanted to use a lot of medical language. I know I've been dealing with liver disease for 15 years. I always feel like I should be given a medical degree because I've learned so much. I really love a lot of that language. I also have wanted to write against that language as much as I've wanted to use it, and to write against the language of transplantation, which is gauzy, gift of life, saying harvesting instead of dissecting the cadaver, you know. So there's been an effort to lyricize, but also, yeah, I think you're right, a distinct effort not to, to try and look at this, at some facts, you know, some stark facts. I am alive, that person is dead. I am alive because that person is dead. And look at them kind of squarely, you know. I do think there are real lyrical flourishes that go on there. Maybe some of the settings, the fact that they're set in hospitals or that it's around surgery sort of takes some of that away. But to my mind, there are places of real kind of heightening that go on in those essays. And against them are poised moments that are much more stark.